Okay, welcome, welcome, welcome to our third show of Crypto Voices, talking about crypto economics and liberty. Matthew Majinskis here, joined by my co-host, Fernando Ulrich. Fernando, how you doing?
I'm great, Matthew. How about you?
Doing well. We were always telling ourselves we'd be talking about more big picture stuff on this show, but it just seems we cannot avoid the topic of the markets and prices.
It's always a crazy week with Bitcoin and crypto.
I remember our first show just 2 weeks ago. The price was about at $2,700. And not long after that, maybe a couple of days, I saw a post from our mutual friend in Brazil, Helio Beltrão. And he said it's the first time he's going to recommend that people take some chips off the table, maybe sell. It looked pretty hot.
True.
The price fell in our second show, like, $800, depending on the exchange, dipped below 2,000. And now as we speak, it's back above 2,800, got very close to 3,000 today. And the all-time, all of the crypto markets together, crypto assets together, have passed, according to CoinMarketCap, $100 billion in market cap. So it's just... it's crazy what a week can do in this market.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the developments that we're seeing now, also with this ICO craze, which I dubbed the insane coin offering. Many of them, some of them are actually insane, but some I think are viable projects. But anyway, it's just, I think, a development of this new world that we're seeing in crypto space. I mean, it really is the internet of money or the internet of value. All that we're seeing developing now, it's amazing to be alive and to witness this development.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we will definitely keep following it and keep, relaying our thoughts on that, but it's just, it's hard to, when you're in the midst of the bubble, it's hard to delineate between speculation and a pure underlying business model. It certainly seems like most is speculation now, but some of this we may come out on the other side and see that there are legitimate underlying business models behind
it's
some
true.
Of these.
This is, and it's actually one of the questions that we have, let's say, not yet answered question. Last week, actually this week's edition of The Economist, the British magazine, they published an article entitled, "Is the Bitcoin bubble, what if the Bitcoin bubble bursts?" And they asked themselves, well, is this a tulip mania, or is it the gold rush, or the dot-com boom again? And my take on it, my economist take on this matter is, in the end, I think Bitcoin is kind of a bubble, but it's a bubble that it's never going to burst. I know perhaps it's a very optimistic case to make, but if we view Bitcoin as a new kind of money, and as any kind of money, a currency, money is in itself a kind of bubble that never bursts. So this is how I view Bitcoin as well. And actually, today I published a video on my YouTube channel in Portuguese with this exact title. Bitcoin is a bubble, but it's never going to burst.
Well said. I don't think I can add anything to that. All right. So let's keep moving on. Today, we are going to talk a little bit about regulation. This is a huge topic. It's a huge topic in regular analog world economics. It's a huge topic in crypto economics and cryptocurrency. But I want to focus it a little bit just sort of on two broad topics. The first is sort of generally to get your take on what governments around the world are saying about cryptocurrency and what some of these implications could be, say, in the short to midterm. And then have maybe a bit more philosophical, but also pretty real world based on what happened about a year ago in Ethereum, the DAO hack. There were definitely some philosophical and internal sort of on the network protocol level regulatory questions that arose from that debacle, some would say. So from that event, to be fair to them. So we're going to talk a little bit about regulation today. So I want to read you a few quotes, a few things that have happened from governments around the world in the last couple months, just to start off here. So first thing, I was watching Bloomberg last week. I saw Mario Draghi, head of the ECB, speak to the European Commission. He said a couple things about fintech and blockchain. He said, fintech is a potentially transformative force, closely monitoring the development. Also, when they feel justified, they can use it, yada, yada, yada. One impact is the innovation of DLT, or distributed ledger technology, such as the blockchain. DLTs can help with lots of great stuff, such as settlement. The risk is fragmentation. There's also peer-to-peer lending platforms. He mentioned traditional ones, such as Lending Club. He did not mention Bitcoin, of course. But they started to mention the panel. The title of the panel was Innovation in FinTech, and they're getting there. People are recognizing it. People are mentioning it. Another one, the Australian government, quoting something from I guess it's the Treasurer's website. They had a tax. It was a consumption tax on Bitcoin, and they said from the 1st of July 2017. Purchases of digital currency will no longer be subject to the goods and services tax, allowing digital currencies to be treated just like money for goods and services tax purposes. Currently, consumers who use digital currencies can effectively bear GST twice, once on the purchase of the digital currency and once again on its use in exchange for other goods and services subject to the GST. That was a 10% tax. Japan also made moves recently, a couple months ago. I'm quoting Deloitte here. The sale of virtual currency as defined under the new fund settlement law will be exempt from Japanese consumer tax. This change will apply to sales / purchase transactions performed in Japan on or after the 1st of July, 2017. That's an 8% tax. China as well made a lot of waves earlier in the year. They are more closely regulating exchange trading, margin trading, cracking down on KYC and withdrawals. There were a lot of exchanges that essentially closed their doors or halted withdrawals for quite a long time, which caused quite a stir. We have last week, Vitalik Buterin from the Ethereum Foundation, co-founder of Ethereum, he met with Vladimir Putin in Russia. They met to discuss blockchain opportunities, quote, blockchain opportunities at the St. Petersburg Economic Conference last week.
That's kind of scary.
That is interesting. There's so much to say about that one. Well, we can tackle that one right now. I live in the former Soviet Union, and there are certainly a lot of Putin's a scary figure, rightfully so. People should be wary of him. He is definitely a modern day dictator. He loves marketing though himself, marketing his country, and whatever you want to say about that. Russia is a basket case economically. They came out over the years for blockchain, against blockchain, for Bitcoin, against Bitcoin. They're just going to play this, I think, the best way that they can. It's interesting. Vitalik is he's a Canadian-born Russian, so he can speak Russian, and that's totally fine. I think there's a lot of great programmers in Russia, and I hope that Bitcoin and blockchain and Ethereum can help the Russian economy. But that one is an interesting one, a scary one. But I always like to tell people who are freaking out about Russia. I mean, if anyone should be sort of freaking, it's people in Eastern Europe. Like I said, I live in the former Soviet Union, but for all of the hubris, for all of the talk that Putin likes to give, the Russian economy is smaller than that of New York City. So I tend to go back to that a lot. New York City is, in fact, bigger than a lot of nation states' economies, but it is bigger than Russia's. So yeah, he's a scary guy. Yeah, they do have nuclear weapons. But that's an interesting one, them getting involved. And then one final one, De La Rue, which is actually a government service provider type company. They work with governments around the world. They basically print money for governments around the world. They work on passports through a lot of strange service. I was reading a little bit about them earlier last week. I saw them as well on Bloomberg. They said a couple interesting quotes, and of course there's a war on cash right now, but they said 85% of all global consumer transactions are still made with cash. And another one, 98% of Indian payments were made in cash before the ban last year on large denominations, which was quite a surprise for many. So a lot of different countries, a lot of different geographies, a lot of different takes and opinions and moves that governments are making on Bitcoin and blockchain. It's a very, you know, we could go so many different ways on this, but do you have any general thoughts on some of these things? You know, what happened, you know, what may be going on in Australia or Japan, or the ECB, the way that they're looking at these currencies. Do you have just any general take on what you think these regulators, these governments are trying to do with Bitcoin and blockchain?
Yeah, sure. I think the status of Bitcoin right now, I think it's a reflection of what Bitcoin is. I mean, it's something completely new, something unprecedented, something we never did this before. I mean, it is on its most essential matter, let's say, it is a protocol, a communication protocol. But what you can do with this protocol is many things. It can be a form of money. It can be a kind of digital commodity. It can be used as a payment system. It can be used to register any kind of information, and it'll be recorded there and will stay there forever. So there are many applications and many use cases with this protocol. So it's difficult to define and even legally define it. I mean, there's no ready box where you can check mark and say this is where Bitcoin should be included. This is what Bitcoin is. It is many things at the same time. So what I mean by that is that right now we have something that regarding regulation, it should be separated in two different camps. One thing is the law treatment itself with Bitcoin. So what Bitcoin is, how it can be used, which kind of tax treatment. So does it apply? Should we apply capital gain taxes on sale of Bitcoin, on Bitcoin sales, on exchanges? Should we apply VAT on the sale of Bitcoins, as Japan just scrapped this tax, but they still have capital gain tax for Bitcoins? So on one side of the regulation debate, we have the treatment that we still have to decide. And most jurisdictions, they have, I'd say, even competing definitions and treatments within themselves. For example, in the United States, we have the Department of Justice, which on one occasion last year, they defined Bitcoin not as a money, just as property. On another case, a money laundering case, they did define it as money, as a kind of private money. But if you take a look on the CFTC, so the Commodity and Futures Trading Commission, their definition or the way they define Bitcoin is a commodity, a digital one, but it is a commodity. And if you look at the IRS definition or the IRS treatment, it is a kind of property, and that's why it's subject to capital gain taxes. And this situation you can find in almost all jurisdictions around the world. It's the same in Brazil, I think in Europe, in the UK, in Japan, and most of jurisdictions. So on one side, we have the law treatment and the limbo where Bitcoin finds itself in many places around the globe. So this is one of the problems with the law. And on the other side, I think, then is regulation itself and how businesses that deal with Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology in general, how these businesses should be regulated. And if the current laws, if they do apply or not to these businesses. So it's two different discussions. On one side is the law treatment and the fiscal or tax treatment of crypto and blockchain. And on the other side is how businesses and individuals, if they deal with Bitcoin, how they should be regulated. So it's two different discussions. And sometimes they get mixed up in the same thing, and they're not the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting and very good that you delineated those two. You know, regarding the taxes, it does seem that people around the world or governments around the world are sort of honing in on the commodity, the digital commodity, the synthetic commodity, and trying to apply some sort of capital gains tax to users to merchants or users when they're selling them. It's interesting, like you said, that there is a little bit more liberalization from some countries taking away some of these purchase taxes, and the EU actually was pretty forward thinking in that for a while. They a couple years ago now announced that VAT, value added tax, would not be applied to it, and the US has not, as far as I'm aware, made an opinion on any sales tax. But generally, it's understood that it's a property, as you said, and it's. Yeah, capital gains tax applies. So that is one thing, and I think that it's still confusing for people to understand that. I think a lot of people that are in Bitcoin even right now, they're not really trading other commodities or really used to that. So that in itself is interesting. But then to your other point, your second point is more concerning for me, because I certainly want Bitcoin to be adopted worldwide, and you know, it seems to be getting better there too, but you know, it's hard to tell. I mean, sometimes you never know what large governments will do if they feel threatened, frankly. And we saw with India how they responded to the war on cash. And then, you know, even in Europe, I remember some cases with early days with Bitcoin, some people had their accounts shut down because it was basically seen that they were trading money in and out of exchanges. Maybe mm-hmm, it was true. MT Gox at the time. So it seems that it's getting better there, but still is a lot of gray area for an individual, a company, a merchant who is just trying to use Bitcoin or cryptocurrency as a more efficient, you know, means in business. I mean, do you think it's just going to be a slow battle, like a slow build?
If we take a look at what happened with the laws and regulation with regards to the internet itself, for example, voice over IP, in many countries, I think it's not yet, it's still in a kind of legal limbo. I know in Brazil, it's the case. So it might take a long time. I mean, I think governments, they still don't understand fully how the internet functions. Now imagine a decentralized protocol that can be used and can be money and a payment system. I mean, I wouldn't expect this to be resolved in the next couple of years. I think it's going to take longer. But I mean, since we have many businesses and exchanges and advocates and people like institutions like the Coin Center in the US, which is headed by Jerry Brito, a great economist. I mean, I think everyone is trying to work with governments, first trying to make them understand what they're trying to regulate and what can even be regulated. Because many of the things they're trying to do, or sometimes their intentions, the government intentions, they're really just impossible to put in place. So they can...
Yeah, and here's the question there. Do you think that it will be a managed... We can use the internet, mm-hmm. certain areas of the internet as example, I guess. Do you think it will be a managed process over the next 5-10 years, or do you think there will be cases where, I mean, this just explodes in some way and we just see that they can't keep up with it?
It's difficult to say. What I think is going to happen is we're going to see some, I think, unfortunately, we're going to see some regulations like we've seen in New York, like with the Bit license. Mm. And it's a disastrous regulation because it really cripples the companies, the startups and the innovation itself. So companies dealing with Bitcoin in New York or dealing with customers in New York, they are just leaving these customers behind and leaving the city, leaving the state of New York. Yeah. But so another issue is that people tend to think, because this is an innovative technology, something that never happened before, and they think it's completely unregulated, they tend to think that businesses that are dealing with Bitcoin and have customers, that these businesses, they are operating on a completely fiscal, illegal limbo. I mean, there are no laws applied to them. And this is a mistake, because already all businesses operating in any country, if they are legally established companies, they are under the laws of those countries. In Brazil, we have this problem. If a Bitcoin exchange in Brazil, if they lose customer funds, they can be sued with the laws we already have. So the current legal framework already deals with any kind of fraud or abuse by a company, and if a customer finds itself being defrauded. So the current laws, they already apply. So they're not operating under a completely fiscal legal limbo.
Do you think they will adapt, though? The current laws will adapt more?
I think some laws might have to be adapted, and perhaps they will try to impose, like, if they view exchanges, for example, if they see exchanges as kind of banks, they will try to impose some kind of capital requirements, as the BitLicense tried to do. And if this is a good thing or not, I'm not yet sure, to be honest, to be perfectly honest with you. I'm not yet sure if that's the case. I tend to think that the market is the best regulator, and the fear of bankruptcy is the best law we can have. I mean, it's the market itself regulating the companies and regulating the behavior of entrepreneurs and businessmen and customers as well, because this is another point of regulations in general. Customers and individuals tend to delegate the responsibility to the regulator. So yeah. The regulator, they make the decisions themselves, and we delegate this task and the responsibility, which should be ours.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And I think that that definitely gets to the next point, which I want to talk about. But before we get to that, can you go back and you mentioned VOIP in Brazil, how it's not maybe regulated still after some time. What did you mean by that?
What I meant is that we still don't have a perfect treatment of voice over IP. So companies that use voice over IP or that offer the service, they might be infringing some kind of regulation because of the legacy telecommunications companies in the country. So this is what I mean, that it's not yet fully understood and treated by our legal system here in Brazil.
Got it. Okay. Moving on to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is more how this regulation will occur on a network level. And I think that is, to me, and I'm sure you would agree, that's one of the, you know, beautiful things, more interesting things about the way that these protocols are set up is, first of all, they're market-based. And then second of all, there is just direct feedback. I mean, I'm going to be releasing on Crypto Voices an article that was read on the Ledger Journal last year, the first publication of Ledger Journal about social contract theory. And, you know, they're going into philosophical things like Hobbes and Rousseau and these things, and how, you know, social contract theory and the Leviathan popped up, and, you know, what sort of rights we want to delegate to the state or not, and doing that in terms of the blockchain. All of that is fascinating, very fascinating stuff to me. I think it's very philosophical. But we have already seen it. We have already seen it in the blockchain world, most notably about a year ago with Ethereum and their DAO event or debacle, as I mentioned earlier. I want to talk about this a little bit because it's a year on. A lot of people have a lot of different opinions, just like everything in cryptocurrency or just in the world in general.
True. It's a hot topic, statement. I mean, this is a hot topic.
Yeah, this topic is really, really, you can push people's buttons if you bring it up and you say something that they don't like. But I think, again, just coming up at it from a more optimistic market point of view, I think that this was a great, like, historic learning experience for a network trying to govern itself. And I think that we learned a lot. Here's my take on the DAO, and I want to get your thoughts. Without going into all the details, basically what happened, it was a decentralized venture capital fund of sorts. It was meant to be sort of funding other projects, sort of the first idea of being an ICO funder, a decentralized venture capital fund. There's already some others that are popping up now.
Imagine that would be
in the DAO's wake and everything else. But basically, they raised, I think at their peak, $150 million.
Yep.
dollars in Ether, and they were operating for no more than a month. They didn't even invest in any projects. It was like a mosh. It was a mosh pit of proposals. It was very unorganized. It was very interesting to see, but nothing happened. There was no actual investments made, you know, in a decentralized fashion. And within a month, the DAO itself, the DAO contract on Ethereum, was hacked. And this represented at the time something like, well, I think, I guess the DAO itself was probably something like 15% of all Ether. I think the Ethereum network was about $1 billion at the time.
True.
So that's, you're talking 15% of the network is locked up in the DAO. Something like 50 or 60 million was hacked. And that means essentially there was a contract in the DAO. The attacker, who is anonymous to this day, was able to do a recursive call function, basically sneak $50 to $60 million out of the DAO contract and into his own wallet. And this obviously was obvious what was happening. Everybody's up in arms. We don't need to get into the technical details. Mm-hmm. The resolution of this was that Ethereum said they wanted to fork. They wanted to nullify this DAO actually the entire DAO, which wasn't much of a contentious decision because the DAO didn't really do anything at that point. It just basically lost customers' money.
True.
So they wanted to nullify the DAO and essentially give everybody their money back and close it down. That was what they actually decided. And what that meant was a hard fork. And they hard forked. So essentially you have a new branch of the old chain is formed. And basically everybody's of the understanding that we're going to go on this new branch and just continue on. And so that the original Ethereum chain actually became, as we all now know today, Ethereum Classic. So Ethereum Classic is actually the original untouched sort of original vision Ethereum chain. And this was fascinating on many levels. It was interesting. Everybody was arguing about it. There were Twitter storms and everybody was going crazy about it. But it happened and they did it. I think it's very interesting to look back at this now a year later. On the surface, we can say, okay, well, what happened to Ethereum? What happened to Ethereum Classic? So everybody got their money back on the Ethereum chain. On the Ethereum Classic chain, nobody got their money back and the attacker had his funds. But what happens with the fork, and those that that aren't aware, is basically everybody that had Ether before this event now has two tokens as long as both branches survive. And during the time, I remember there were some miners that were saying on the Ethereum, the forked chain, they said, I'm going to attack this Ethereum Classic chain. This isn't legitimate. Let's just be done with this. But that actually proved to not be enough. And so the Ethereum Classic chain survived. Without going through all the details of the last year, we can look at least today and say it seems that the Ethereum proper, which is the forked chain now, the Ethereum community, they supported what happened with the DAO. Ethereum is $250 plus, $260 in the market. Ethereum Classic is $17. They were both under $20 when this happened. And, you know, it's just a very interesting, it's a very interesting thing to look back at because there was a market resolution, even though this problem was contentious, even though people were throwing out words like bailout, I think justifiably so. This was the resolution they chose. Now, I want to take this just a little bit further before I get your response, Fernando. I think forgetting all the technical issues, forgetting the definition of a fork or having two coins after it happens and this very confusing, all this confusing jargon, what if we just look at this like it was an analog institution? What if we looked at it like it was a bank and say the bank was robbed or the bank had an ATM and the ATM was robbed? Now, forget all of the code. The code is law, or this or that. The bank just had an ATM. The ATM was robbed, or it was hacked. Clearly, the spirit of that ATM is that for its users, for its shareholders of the bank, it's not meant. That's not meant to happen. It's not meant to be hacked. It's not meant to be stolen. Funds to be stolen from. But let's say it happens. What then is the response from the bank and its shareholders? I think it's basically one of two things can happen. One is they're unprepared, and they don't have video surveillance, they don't have insurance, they don't have this, that, and that basically the thief, the hacker, the attacker of the ATM, he runs off with the money. The other option is they are prepared in some way for some recourse. They have insurance, they have video surveillance, they may go to law enforcement, they may try to catch the thief, get the money back, but maybe the board makes a decision to pay some money if it's a big theft and you know, clients lose money, but probably that we'll never get to that. You'll have insurance will kick in. But that's what happens in the real world. In the real world, we have insurance, we have recourse, we have some sort of preparation, ideally, for events that are unforeseen. I think it's honestly no more complicated than that in the crypto world. It got very heated, very philosophical. People were saying it was a bailout. People were saying that the attacker was actually justified in getting the funds because he was just using the contract, like he said. And the Slack.it people that started it, they were, in my opinion, being a bit too hubristic and saying code is law and the iron will of the code will govern the DAO. They were a bit too aggressive with their marketing. So I think all these opinions were justified of people getting upset. But at the end of the day, the market made a decision. They did choose to return the funds, and Ethereum, the original chain, or the Ethereum proper, let's call it, which is actually the new branch, they now have a $24 billion market cap, which is $22.5 billion more than Ethereum Classic. So what do you think about that analysis of...
Well, the let's say the analog equivalent of your analogy, it would be for the bank to go back in time and prevent the ATM robbery. And so this is one of the fascinating things of this space. That's not really possible. In blockchain technology, you can go back in time, let's say, and roll back the blockchain until the point the attack never happened, or to prevent an attack. So you can do this going back in time, which you cannot do in our real world, in the physical world, of course.
So I take the point. But what that gets back to more technical crypto sort of terminology. What if Ethereum had much stronger tools? Like, remember at the time too, mm-hmm. they were doing Twitter polls, mailing lists, vote. Like, they didn't have many tools to actually take a vote about what people really thought. And if people, I think most of the DAO token holders were probably whales, so to speak, in the Ethereum community. They had a lot of ether, so they're probably just bailing out themselves. But let's just say they had great tools. Let's say that you could take a democratic vote. Everybody had a one-to-one vote for how much DAO tokens they had, how much ether they were holding for the sake of the network. And let's say it was, I mean, that's what blockchain is supposed to be for, right? Like, transparent. My point is, I guess, I think, I don't disagree with you. You can go back in time, but this is the really interesting thing about what crypto and blockchain regulation can do is, let's say they had great tools. We can transparently say 99.5% of the whole community wants to hard fork, and they do it. Then I think it's a totally legitimate decision by the network. And then I think the only other question is basically what other users outside of the network will think, you know? And
of course,
how does the Bitcoin network react, or how does the Dash network react? The interesting thing to me.
I do agree with this, with your take on the matter. And I guess the market will decide upon the decisions taken by the Ethereum Foundation in the future, because this precedent is something that now everybody knows what can happen if we have another instance of a hack, a robbery, or whatever, stolen funds, whatever you name it. And actually, this past week, we had an instance like this. I can't remember I think it was an ICO, and I can't remember what the name of it. And now the discussion came again, should we go back and stop this robbery? Should we roll back the blockchain to stop this aggressor or not? And so we're going to have this again in the future, because Ethereum is such a complex system. And with all this ICO craze, this is going to happen again.
Yeah,
and I think the community now expects that Vitalik and the Ethereum Foundation, they will again bail out whoever loses, if they think and if they can define, well, this is an actual robbery, it's an attacker, it's, as Vitalik said, this is a net harm for the blockchain, for the Ethereum, so we will do this. So I think the precedent sets the expectations of users around Ethereum for the longer term. So this is one thing, but I think it's perfectly legal and a great way to see the market resolving these kind of issues. And that's what makes me really fascinated and enthusiastic about crypto in general. I mean, this is what's fantastic about it. We're seeing, and this is another point, another misunderstanding by the layman and the public in general when they say, well, these cryptocurrencies, they're completely unregulated. I mean, nobody controls them. When in fact, it's the complete opposite. I mean, it's a perfect self-regulated system. And everybody, yes, all users, not only developers, miners, full nodes, but all users, they are constantly monitoring and making sure the rules are being followed by everyone in the space. And this is beautiful to observe, especially when we compare this 21st century financial and monetary system, when we compare this with the other thing, with what we have now, the current paradigm in the monetary space, where we have some committees, so the politburos, making decisions, and decisions upon which everyone, every single individual in those jurisdictions, they are obliged to follow by. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's a good decision or not. We are obliged to abide by those rules and by those decisions taken by a handful of people. And yes, as we see in India with this crazy and this monstrosity of banning or forbidding and outlawing some cash bills, rupee bills, I think it was the 1,000 and the 5,000, I can't remember. I mean, this is a monstrosity. This is really something, the president should be jailed by doing this. But anyway, they have the power, they can impose such atrocities, such financial oppression on their population. And this can never happen in the crypto space, never. It doesn't matter if it's Ethereum, Bitcoin, or any other. It's a voluntary system. And if they do harm, and if it's viewed by the users as something harmful, they will just flee the currency, and there's nothing any developer, miner, or foundation can do about it.
Yes, I completely agree. I think you summed it up perfectly. That's basically, you know, what I was getting at with the my take on the DAO fiasco. I think, first of all, tools will continue to get better, more transparent, more clear, more understandable as far as where the community stands on some of these issues in the future. And second of all, there will definitely be issues. Like, we're not saying that this is a perfect technology or that there's not going to be issues. I think that there's going to be a multitude.
Oh yeah.
Whether it's on Ethereum itself with all of their ERC-20 tokens and the crowd sales, or even on Bitcoin. I mean, let's not forget, the user activated soft fork is a potentially contentious issue, just like SegWit and just like hard forking to 2 megabytes. So there are just so many scenarios that could play out. I think it makes everybody think twice. It makes developers think twice. It makes attackers think twice. It makes users think twice about, you know, what's the most proper, prudent, most efficient way to hold my money to transfer value over the internet. Everybody's got to think about it. And I think, we're not in the era of FDIC or mm-hmm. deposit backed insurance with blockchain. I mean, this is,
it's certainly the best,
we're in the bleeding edge, new paradigm, as you said. So I think it's great. I think we'll continue to see hard decisions. We may not agree with all of them, but mm-hmm. they are market based, which is very, very interesting.
That's the beauty of the whole thing.
All right. Well, fantastic. That's all I had today. You want to? Do you have anything else, Fernando?
No, I think for today that's all. But as usual, there's so many topics, hot topics, so many new developments. We could do a 40-week-long podcast, 40-hour-long podcast, nonstop.
Yeah, it is. It is absolutely amazing. We could go for weeks on each topic, it seems, but. but we'll have to limit it to 30 to 40 minutes each time.
Sure.
But I'd like to tell our users that we certainly are working on interviews. We're going to have some great guests line up. It's not just going to be Crypto Voices, Fernando's voice, and Matthew's voice. So we are working on it. We're looking forward to continuing the discussion and hope that you're enjoying this.
All right, Matthew. Great discussion as usual, and see you next time.
All right. Sounds great, Fernando. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Take care.